You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, episode
44.
40 every goddamn time. Yeah. I was about to say 43, too. 43-2. Episode 432.
Time jump. We're
in the future now. I'm 600 years old. Yeah. We're recording from outer space.
Yep. Yeah, the space station's nice out here. The weather's great.
The weather's great. There's no weather screen.
It's part of the joke.
I don't get jokes. Okay, so in this episode,
we have a guest. We have a lovely guest, our day one fan from the very beginning, probably our biggest fan, I would like to think, Summer Farah, or Farah. We get into those pronunciations in the episode, and other fun things about her being Palestinian-American, growing up in L.A. and Michigan, and also being a Berkeley student.
And a poet.
And a beautiful poet.
Wouldn't you know it?
Oh,
look at me. All right, listen.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are ethnically ambiguous.
We are recording episode 44.
Today. It's 44?
It's 44.
Are you sure?
Yep. I always put on my calendar the number so I can feel on top of it. But this week, we are joined with a very special guest. Our number one, probably very first fan of this podcast.
Yeah, our only person actually probably still listens to it.
Summer Farah.
Yay.
Farah.
Who knows? It's all different because, you know, Arabic and English, they're...
Yeah. Because in Arabic, I would say
Farah. Yeah. Maybe Summer Farah.
But I don't know how you would say it in, like...
English-ized. Yeah.
But yeah, this is Hello. You. You're here.
I'm here.
You would say it like Farah, like Farah Fawcett, right?
I guess so.
Summer Farah Fawcett.
Yeah. I was actually having this conversation with my mom like yesterday. Because about like, so like my name is like Summer, but it's like not actually Summer. It's Samar, which is like an Arabic name. And she was saying, I don't remember what, you know, I just talk about, like, wax about my name all the time. Like, it doesn't sound Arab enough. No one understands me. And she was talking about, like, oh, I asked our relatives in America, like, how to spell it. And this is what they told me. But, like, you know, your name isn't also Farah either, right? It's Farah. And I was like, yeah, I know. Let's just, like, not undo my sense of self right now. Like, I correct people on the roll call all the time. Like, let's just, like, leave it. Yeah. But, yeah, Farah. Summer Farah.
My dad has a brother named Hisham. My mom has a brother named Hisham. And they're both married to women named Samar.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's a good name.
They have the same name and they're both married to women with the same name.
Yep. I love that.
It's insane. It's a parallel universe if I've ever seen one. Yeah.
Are they family? Like, relations again?
So my mom's brother, her younger brother is Hisham. Yeah. My dad's younger brother, also Hisham. Both happen to marry a woman named Samar.
Okay. Yeah. It's like, you know. Those Arab names. I keep doing stuff with my hands, and I know no one will ever see that.
But it's an Arab thing, and just own like, it. Just Middle Eastern gesturing.
I have to make sure that I'm filling words with my gestures, otherwise, like, all my sentences are incomplete.
So, how did you find us?
Yeah, so when y'all were on Feral, there was, like, I listened to Doughboys, which is, you know, some fun stuff. And before an episode, there's just your ad, like, before the episode. And it was like, hey, we're going to talk about being Middle Eastern. And I was like, what? What? A podcast that's not two white heterosexual men? And I was like, hell yeah. And then I listened. I think there was only two episodes when I started listening. No, Whoa. There was one. There was one episode when I started listening.
Dude, that is early days.
Truly OG. Yeah, it was truly like the first episode. And yeah, I was sitting. This was last summer when I was working at the Getty, which was a hell job. No, it was great. No, it's fine. But just like sitting at a sad desk in a big cubicle alone, listening to y'all.
And
like,
this is in Berkeley?
No, this was in LA. Oh, so I was in LA for the summer. Okay.
We did launch in the summer. Or like, yeah.
We launched like this time last year-ish, right?
Yeah.
1 year anniversary coming up.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah, y'all like have a new episode every week. That's amazing. Yeah. It's exhausting. Have you ever taken a break?
We took one break for New Year's, I think.
Right? We did. Yeah, we did.
We released on Christmas because naturally Middle Easterners don't acknowledge Christmas. I mean, we do, but like we know.
Hey,
know?
I'm Christian.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know this
My
about
family's
you.
From Nazareth. So Jesus.
Jesus.
I like to say like, you know, Jesus.
You guys celebrate
my
Christmas?
Uncle. Yeah.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, I know, right? It's
Where is Nazareth for people that don't know?
So it's in Israel, I guess, whatever. Mm-hmm. If you want to call that Israel. But yeah, so it's in Israel. It's probably like the highest concentrated Palestinian Christian population. Or I don't know. I think there's a city in the West Bank that's also pretty Christian. But yeah, it's geographically in Israel, I don't really know. But yeah.
So Anna mentioned Berkeley. You go to Berkeley.
I go to Berkeley for school. My family lives in LA area, so I'm actually visiting them right now before I go back up to Berkeley.
Perfect timing for
us. I was like, I'm gonna be in LA. Shereen, what's up?
And I was like, be on our podcast.
I was like,
what an opportunity.
My biggest dream to be on a podcast.
This is your first time ever on
my
a podcast.
My first time ever, yeah. Even though I like talk about having a podcast all the time, I don't actually know what goes into it.
Maybe you need to start one.
Yeah, I want to.
Is there a podcast network at Berkeley?
So we have like the campus radio station, they have 24 hours, 7 days a week of content, but they do every single thing live, and they don't do anything, they don't really do, like, talk radio at all. It's all, like, music, and then, like, public safety. So I've talked to them about, like, hey, what if I did, like, some recorded content?
Yeah.
And they're like, no.
Oh, okay. It's chill.
Weird.
Yeah.
I'll call Berkeley after this.
Yeah, no, let them know. Be like, excuse me.
File a complaint.
Yeah. And I know that other college campuses, their radio stations do, like, recorded content. Like, my friend goes to UC Santa Cruz, and he does, like, radio stuff there. And they have podcast. They have so many podcast collectives. It's wild.
In Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They have a bunch of podcast collectives, and I think they do like broadcast recorded content because it's like, do students really want to be on the radio at like 3:30 a.m.?
Well, that's the thing at UC Davis. Like when you join KDVS, which is our station, your first shift was like the 2 to 4 a.m.
Yeah.
That was
and then
like
you had
the
to like build your way up to like a normal hour.
Yeah. That's how it is at Berkeley too. And it's like I went to like some of the orientations for the radio station and they would talk about like the glamour of like 4 a.m. CD organizing with your fellow radio volunteers. And I was just like,
it's like we all had to do it.
Like, no, thank you. Just let me in on the like fun stuff. I don't want to work for it. I'm so sorry.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
It's like hazing, but like in a weirder way.
Well, the thing is about our school radio, it was like you had to be like real hip.
So hip. And it was mostly just like people that wanted to show you music that no one has heard of but them.
Yeah, I remember because, you know, my friend Evan, mm-hmm. I remember he got in trouble once because he played a song that was just a tiny bit too mainstream. Mm. But it wasn't mainstream at all. Like, it was actually quite obscure, but it wasn't like obscure enough for
him. Oh my God.
How dare
he? Yeah, and he was just like, yeah, they pointed it out and gave me a talking to or something. Like,
this song was played on the actual radio, Evan.
Yeah, which is not good. Oh my God, get out of your own asshole,
oh my
you
God.
Know?
Yeah.
Wait, so what do you study in Cal?
So I'm studying English major. Yeah, my major is English.
I'm sorry, how do your parents feel about this?
Oh, yeah. I can get into that.
Yes, please.
So I have an older brother, Hanny, who is like 7 years older than me. And when he was in high school, you know, get into colleges and stuff, he didn't get into Berkeley, which was like his number one school, but he got into San Diego. He went there. He did poli sci and history, and then he's a lawyer now. Mm-hmm. So, nice. Like, he knew what he wanted when he was in college. He's like, I'm going to go to the... Because, like, UCSD has, like, 30... whatever. Yeah. He was in the one that was, like, makes you have a history minor. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, perfect. I love these things. Yeah. I know exactly what I'm doing with my life. Mm-hmm. No fear. He probably had fear, but he didn't express these to me. So, like, he became a lawyer. My parents were like, chill. Summer,
someone to be proud of. Yeah.
Like... You're going to be a lawyer, right? Like, you're, like, smart. And I'm like, And, like, one point in my life, I wanted to be a dermatologist because I have eczema. So I was like, I will fix the thing that is wrong with me.
Yeah.
But, like, I can't look at anything gross, like, ever. Like, I've fainted in classes before. Like, just, like, in middle school, we were having, like, STD class, whatever. And, like, our teacher showed us pictures of, like, STDs, like, and I passed out. Yeah.
You're like, this isn't for me.
Yeah, I was like, I can't
I'm the same way.
It.
I can't see any blood. Well, I can't see anything.
I didn't know that about you. I don't know if I did.
Yeah, it's like when my parents would be like, oh, you can go to med school. And I was like, world?
No, but it's interesting that you said that about wanting to fix something that was wrong with you. Because that was why I wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I want to fix my brain, and I want to help people that have fucked up brains just like me. And then I realized when I took chemistry at 16 that I can't do that.
Yeah.
that just does not compute in my brain, and I had to move on.
So later, as like my mental health got worse, mm-hmm. I started thinking like, oh, maybe I could be like psychologist, therapist, mm-hmm. but also like people's suffering also makes me faint.
Yes.
Yeah.
So like I'll be like watching something and it'll be sad and I'll like pass. Like, my mom was watching this Turkish drama this morning, and she was watching it with like the Arabic dub, so like I understood some of it but most of it not. And so she was like narrating everything that's happening to me, and she's like, oh, this woman was raped by her like fiance. And I was like, can you not say that? Like, my knees feel weak. I am like steaming clothes right now. I don't need to hear about people suffering unless I'm very ready for it. So I was like, can't do that. And my dad is like computer science dude, mm-hmm. does like systems for Kaiser. We used to live in Michigan, and he did like hella stuff for the university, and just like, he's genius, brilliant. So they were like, how about computer science? Right. And I was like, that sounds really boring.
Yeah.
They're like, but you can be creative with it. Your dad is creative. He builds things with code. And I'm like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Creativity. Okay. Like, whatever. I went into Berkeley, and my first semester I took my like required writing class, a Shakespeare class, and then not the intro computer science class, but the class for like non-majors.
Yeah.
So just to like get a feel for it. And it was hell. It was the worst thing I've ever done in my entire life. I hated it.
So was it all just coding?
Yeah. Ugh. It was all coding. And like the projects were really fun, actually. Mm-hmm. Like it was like group work, which is like, it was actually surprisingly fun. Because for the most part, I just got to think of like what we were going to design, and then other people would help me code it. So like that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But then the tests were like on paper, so you have to handwrite code.
Whoa.
And you can't like push a button to test it.
You just have handwriting to like, you just turn it like in. A nightmare. Yeah.
It was the worst. I did so bad. And then like I was enrolled for like the actual intro computer science course for majors until like a week before classes start. And I like talked to my parents. I was like, hey, just thinking about taking this class hypothetically is making my anxiety like 8,000%. I want to enjoy school. Can I just study English? And they were like, okay, yeah, but you have to be the best at it. Can you be the best at it? And I was like, I don't know, sure.
That's interesting you talk to them, because I would have never spoken to them. I would never even acknowledge their opinion. Because I remember in high school or whatever, my dad kept being like, take computer science courses. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, totally. No. And then I would just sign up for something else.
Yeah. Sure. No, I didn't tell my parents when I started doing film instead of whatever I was supposed to be doing. Because they thought
What did you come in as?
I went in, I got in as like an art studio, because I did AP photo in high school and I was really into it. And I thought I wanted to study photography. And then when I got in, my dad called me at orientation and like made me cry and like forced me to change it. And so out
How
of spite.
Did he know?
I called him like excited.
Oh no.
Dads are the worst.
Well, I mean, like, he's apologized for this since then. But I changed it out of spite to the dumbest thing I can think of, and apologies to anyone else that studied this, because it is my double major, but communication. Mm-hmm. And so I changed it to that out of spite, which is something you always should do about your future, to make a decision out of spite. But then I also double majored in film and then art history later on.
Wow.
But I didn't tell him when I first did film, because I was just like trying to sneak it in, because I was like, well, maybe he'll still think I'm like, I don't know, because at the time my mom was like, well, yeah, if she does communication, maybe she can still go to law school. Like, yeah, because she wanted me to be the next Judge Judy.
That's aspirational.
Yeah. I'm curious, do they have any way of finding out what your major or like what classes you're taking?
So it depends on like, so like my dad handles all the tuition payment stuff for me. So it's all on like my portal where you pay for shit. So like you can see like major, GPA, like I'm in like the College of Letters and Sciences, courses and all that stuff. So like I think I'm pretty different than most people in that I do talk to my parents about most things. Like I'm very
That's good.
Open. Yeah. A lot of it's like very frivolous things. Like I'll be like, "Hi mom, I'm walking to class and this is what I had for breakfast," kind of things. But
my
I'm
parents
very...
love that shit though.
Yeah,
my
no.
parents love that shit.
Like
that's cool.
One of the biggest things every time I talk to my mom on the phone is like, "Oh, what did you eat today? What did you go grocery shopping for?" And it's like easy questions.
I called my mom and told her that she would ask me not to call her.
But your mom is like on another level.
Yeah, she's got shit to do. She's not interested in what I had for lunch.
Oh no, it's like her biggest concern.
Yeah, my parents love to ask me what I ate.
All the time.
So wild. My mom just assumes I'm eating shit.
Yeah,
I don't even know.
Make sure I'm
yeah,
not.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, she's like, make sure that like whatever she raised me with carries on when I'm out of the home, so that I'm not like, you know, I'm still buying like grass fed beef, and not like just shoveling Cheetos into my mouth, which happens.
Yeah, it does.
But, yeah.
Even before I got here, I was on the phone with my mom, and she was like, what's for dinner? And I was like, I don't know. And she was like, what? Make something good.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay.
What's thanks, for mom. Dinner? What are these conversations you guys have with your parents?
I think my mom and dad are both, like, just softies at heart, and they just like hearing us on the phone, whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes my mom will straight up be doing, like, a completely different thing and not be near the phone, and I'll call her and she'll answer and like just have me like babbling into like dead space, and she cannot respond. She's very busy, and I'll be like, I can call back later, and she's like, no, it's okay, just like talk. I'm like, okay. I'm talking to myself, but that's fine.
So ultimately though, they were like, they weren't unsupportive when you did English.
Yeah, so they were like, so I think I had gone into school wanting to just do English. I was very resistant to computer science, but I told them I would try it and I would end up doing a combination of computer science and English, whether it be like majoring in computer science, minoring in English, whatever. There was this like, so there's a program at Stanford that's like computer science and English combined.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, if I get in there, then I can like, you know, justify everything.
Right.
But that didn't happen. And now Berkeley's trying to start that, actually. They're, like, combining classes. It's weird. But, yeah, so they were, like, skeptical because they were just, like, we just don't want you to, like, we want you to be able to support yourself.
Yeah.
And, like, we don't know how you can do that.
They want you to have health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, which is, like, fair in just, like, studying English and, like, being pretty involved with just the community. It's so shitty. Like, the amount of, like, unpaid internships, the amount of work it takes just to, like, have your labor valued in any way is absurd.
Yeah.
I cannot believe it. But, yeah, so they were, like, they were just like worried. They were like, we want you to be like safe and like healthy and be able to buy the things you want and live places and not be worried all the time. And I'm like, yeah, no, I want that too. Mm-hmm. But I can't do that if I'm like doing computer science.
Yeah.
Because I think the thing is, my parents kind of just look at me and they're like, our daughter is the best no matter what she's doing. She's the most beautiful. She's the most talented. So like the idea that I'm not in something is just like alien to them. Mm-hmm. They're like, she's studying computer science, so of course she will be $1 million Google like CEO or whatever.
Yeah.
But I was just like, but I'm not good at this thing. So like no one's gonna hire me for this thing.
Yeah.
Why would I study it?
That's an interesting thing. I remember my dad was like, you should go to law school, you're a good talker. And I was like, yeah. That's not all it takes.
My parents said the same thing to me.
Same
you
thing.
Need to be able to do work. Yeah. Like, read.
Mom was
take
like,
an info.
Mom was like, you're angry and you care about people. You should be a judge. And I was like,
yeah.
That's like harder than that, though. It's harder.
Judge Jeanine Pyro, whatever that psycho lady is. She hates everyone.
I don't know who
she's
that
a perfect
is.
Judge.
My mom and I, like, we every time I go to San Diego, we watch Judge Judy together. She
that's
loves
so
Judge
cute.
Judy.
Judge Judy.
Yeah, it's an adorable trait of hers. What I want to ask, I wanted to ask you...
Before that, what is your parents' situation? Did they immigrate here? Are you first generation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so my dad immigrated here when he was, like, 11.
Okay, so it sounds like they've got more, like, American ideals in the sense of they support you at all costs.
Yeah,
like,
so my dad immigrated
true?
Here
yeah.
when he was 11, and then my mom immigrated here after she married my dad, actually. He was, like, visiting Nazareth for a bit, and then, like... They, like, met, they dated for 4 months, they got married, and she's like, I'm American now.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, she got real her chicken out of there. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's that.
So where was your father raised, in America?
In Michigan, in Flint.
Okay.
There's a big air community over there.
Yeah.
Dearborn, shout out Dearborn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so he grew up in Flint, and I think my family started like churches there or something. I don't really know.
Cool.
Something like that. But yeah, I know there's like a huge, there's a huge Arab population in Michigan. I think like specifically in Flint for a while, there was a huge like Palestinian Christian population.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like where we all going.
Yeah.
Yeah. For some reason. I don't know.
Well, since your dad was here when he was 11 and then, well, I guess he went back and married your mom.
Mm-hmm.
Were you raised with your parents speaking to you in Arabic?
Yeah. So my parents would... So, yeah. So they basically speak to us in Arabic, and then my brother and I would respond in English.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother is older than me, and he... Arabic was his first language, and he, like, started school. And then the people at school were like, hey, this kid needs to speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And, like... actually only English. He shouldn't know another language. His learning Jeez, will be stunted.
That's so rude.
Yeah. And so my parents freaked out, and they're like, oh, shit. Yeah. Our child, he won't be the best like we want him to be. So I think they overcorrected a little, and then we're like, okay, the next child, she will not speak any Arabic. So, like, I can understand, like, really domestic things.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, ifitdao and, like, you know, food words.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like... Yeah, so basically everything that happens in the confines of a kitchen, fluent.
A great woman.
Yeah, you know? but yeah, so, and like my parents, so now like in college I started taking Arabic classes.
Nice.
And so like now my parents will start speaking to me in Arabic for a little bit. I'll hold a conversation and then like there will be something I don't know and then we'll drop back into English.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so now I know Arabic better than my brother. But
ooh, nice.
That's interesting. Yeah. I was able to maintain both, and my English is perfect.
My English is pretty shitty still, actually. No, it's not. But I do say some stuff wrong. But when I was growing up, me and my sister, my older sister, both had accents, and we got made fun of a lot, and they wanted to put my sister in ESL.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were like, no, she can speak both. Just because she has an accent doesn't mean she doesn't understand you. Like,
yeah.
We got a lot of shit for that. But
yeah, I think it was definitely just like racist teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
boils down to that, I think.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate.
Michigan, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd think like, yeah, I think it was a school in Ann Arbor. I know exactly which school it was, actually. Not going to name names.
We'll ask you some more fun stuff after the break.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Yay!
See that? Magic,
amazing.
Right? Podcast magic.
There was just like advertisements like rolling above my eyes.
Yeah. So you write poems.
I do write poems.
I want to get into, as someone who also loves poetry and writes poems, I want to talk about how you got into writing poems, and also I've read some poems of yours that are about Palestine that are heartbreaking and like that I really relate to, just eating watermelon with your family or just like, stuff like that. And then recently I also want to talk about how you and a bunch of Palestinian poets and writers up in Berkeley made a response to what was happening in for the Nakba.
Yeah.
So I want to get into all of those. So take the wheel.
Yeah. So I guess like kind of going back to just language stuff. So my dad grew up, knowing Arabic because he lived in Nazareth for the first 11 years of his life. And I think his English, eventually was fine. And he's fantastic now. But it caused him a lot of like problems in school. And so I think that, like, when it came to raising me and my brother, he was just like, okay, reading and writing, that's the thing. That's what will get you ahead in life. So it was, like, my whole life, like, you have to read. You have to be able to write. And that's the only way you'll ever be good at anything. And, I mean, yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
No matter how often, I don't know, like, I guess one of the, going to, like, such a STEM-heavy college, it's very, like, yeah, like, you know, people that do chem or whatever, like, they'll never get any money for their research if they don't know how to write grant proposals to make you feel better for studying English and stuff. So I was always just reading a lot. Classic, I guess. And in high school, I started, or I guess I was always writing like weird, like short stories and stuff. But in high school, I started like writing poetry, I guess. I was actually reading poetry. I think the first book, like, I mean, we read poetry at school, whatever. I liked when we read like Langston Hughes and Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is my favorite part of school. But I bought my first book of poetry, and it was Crush by Richard Sykin. And I think it was a lot of people's first book of poetry, I've found, as I've like gotten into poet community. And it was just this beautiful, beautiful, heartbreaking book full of like just angsty love poetry, stunning. And I was like, oh, poetry can be whatever I want it to be. And so I started writing and learning about like slam and spoken word poetry. And I was like, I want to do this. Yeah. And I didn't get the opportunity until I got to college. But the spoken word group on campus, which I organize with now, Cal Slam, was having like writing workshops. And I was like, wow, fun. So I did that for a little bit. And then they had their qualifying slam for like CUPSI, which is a spoken word college slam tournament that happens every year. And I competed, and then I made finals. I didn't make the team, but I got, like, into the community. Mm-hmm. And so I started, like, writing with other people, and I started learning that you could, like, write about your ethnicity. You don't have to write love poems.
Right.
And I think that's really where I started kind of, like, honing my writing skills and, like, understanding who I was as a writer and, like, what I could do with language. It was, like, I come from a half bilingual background, just like this weird sense of struggling to grasp at another language that I know I should know and like finding the ways to understand it. Poetry was a really, really helpful in doing that, and just like being able to speckle Arabic words throughout my works and use them in the ways that I barely understand them, but expanding on them. And just like Arabic is such a good language. It's so rich. Everything is so much more than it sounds. Like one word, like my name, Samar, it means like evening conversations for short, but then at long is like sitting on a porch with family and friends in the evening, sipping coffee as the wind blows by. And it's just like, what the fuck? Like,
that's nice.
Yeah, right? It's just like, that's a good name. And just, yeah, so I started getting more and more into it. And then, so I organized with Cal Slam, and we put on open mics and slams, and we do workshops, and it's cool because poetry feels like my most comfortable form of activism. I feel like shitty a lot of the times because like I'm definitely someone who just retweets things and like posts on Facebook, and then like, but yeah, but because I just like, it's so hard for me to show up because I just, my anxiety is bad. I'm afraid of people. Every time a Zionist has talked to me, I've just been like, I'm terrified right now.
And
poetry has felt like one of the outlets that, even though people will like be cruel to me for it in certain ways, it's my strongest outlet. Yeah. And it helps me speak like about myself and things that I don't really know how to say. And I've found that when I perform, there's always like at least one person in the audience who comes up to me afterwards and is just like, I'm Arab too. This is so cool. I don't know any Arab spoken word poets. And it makes me really happy. Like one time at an open mic, I did a poem and it was about my name. And then a girl left the room and she came back and she signed up to do the open mic. And she went on the mic and she did a poem that she wrote in 5 minutes. And she's like, this is After Summer. And I was like, holy shit. Oh my God, this is the best thing that's ever happened in my life. Someone just like heard one of my poems and then was like, gotta go write my own. And it was just really cool. And I found like so much more community through it. Like before I got to college, I don't think I really ever met another Palestinian person that wasn't related to me. Like I knew other Arabs, but like specifically, very few, but specifically Palestinian, which was like weird in a way. I was just like, why? Where are we? And then getting to college, it was like there's just like a big community, and like the student groups on campus would like invite me to read, and like all that stuff. And it was just like kind of cool to have people directly connecting with my work in a way that was so incredibly specific to a lived experience. So the thing that you're talking about, the Palestinian poets respond to the Nakba. So that was put together by Tariq Luthan. He is a Palestinian poet based in Detroit, and he is amazing. Like, I met him last year at a reading. Students for Justice in Palestine, they're like a nationwide student group. A lot of schools have chapters, invited him, or was it Bears for Palestine? One of our groups invited him to come to like a Palestinian night of spoken word and music, and he performed, and I think he was the first Palestinian poet I knew, but like, yeah. And we just connected after that. And then also, internet is amazing for meeting people. Like, you know, yeah. Both of y'all have talked to you solely online. Around just like leading up to Nakba during Return March, he gathered just a bunch of people into a group chat on Facebook and was like, hey, y'all, I have talked with a Lit Hub editor and we are going to do a Nakba thing. Let's just put together a folio of work. And it was amazing. I was working with, like, I was just like, I'm in the same folio as like some of my favorite poets, like these amazing, amazing people. And we put it together in 3 days. Some of the poems in that folio are brand new. Like mine, I wrote the morning that Tariq like told us to come together. He and George Abraham edited it in like 2 hours and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it felt productive, like we were doing something real. Wow. Which is weird because, like, I feel like I write so much and it's just like, who's reading this? What mm-hmm. am I doing? Like, yeah. Especially as an English major, like, that essay about T.S. Eliot I wrote, no one's going to read that. It's not important. But, yeah.
That's awesome.
It's talked for, like, 3 minutes cool. straight.
No, I'm glad. That's why you're here. That's why you're here. We did retweet that Lit Hub post a while ago when it came out, but you can look for it on our Twitter. And read Summer's and a lot of other Palestinian poets' work. Summer is an incredible poet, and I'm not just saying that because you're here. Like, I cried when I read some of your stuff because I never, very rarely use Arabic in my poetry, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason, I don't know why that is. It's not that I'm ashamed of it. It's that I love being Arab, but it's hard for me to talk or to utilize that part of myself. So the fact that you can do it so beautifully is so inspiring, and like I wish I could do half of what you're able to do with Arabic. It's just beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Compliments. I feel like that my poetry wasn't really its fullest self until I started thinking about the parts of my identity that needed to be written out more, I guess, if that makes sense. I try to be as intentional as possible when I use Arabic because it feels kind of weird. It feels like a cop out, like, I don't know. So like my roommate, who's also big into poetry scene, they're amazing. We talk a lot about, so slam poetry, it's not like a type of poetry. It's like the competition of poetry, which I think is a misconception a lot. So slam poetry, it's like a 3-minute poem and then random judges score you on a scale from like 1 to 10. And I go to a lot of them. I don't compete because competition. My roommate and I talk a lot about like buzzwords in slam and like things like that will just kind of get you points that feel exploitative at times, where it's just like you're using language in your work.
Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, so I guess like if I just kind of use the word like occupation over and over and over again as a Palestinian poet.
Yeah.
Or like just intifada and just just kind of very familiar things that have a lot of meaning attached to them but may not be unpacked, just kind of to grab people's attention. And it feels
exploitative almost.
Yeah. And it's just in thinking about like when I use Arabic, if I'm using the word like Habibti, like am I using it because the memory that I'm writing about, I hear that word in the memory? Like, did my mom say that to me? Did my dad say that to me? Or am I using it as like a grabber to have people mm-hmm. like hear and be like, oh, she has another language attached to her. And I think it's like really hard to think about, especially with like not being fluent, how I'm using the language and how I'm thinking about my identity and making sure I'm not using it for like fodder and mm-hmm. like as a way to like get published. I mean, like being Palestinian isn't going to get you published.
Right.
But
I understand what you mean. Yeah. I think about that all the time. I don't want to bank on me being Syrian or Arab or like I think maybe that's why I never wrote about it, because I didn't want that to be the reason why I was writing or something. But honestly, after reading your stuff, I want to put Arabic in my poetry, because it is a big part of me that I've almost like shut off because it makes me so emotional.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the thing is, it helps so much work through things. Like sometimes just writing for yourself, mm-hmm. I think, is really important. And thinking about like what's something that I need to like get through, something I need to understand about myself. Yeah. Like I think that like I have issues with like eating stuff, and like I have tons of poem, like all my poetry, there's like food shit in it. And like just being able to use that, not necessarily engaging with like binge eating or like starving myself or whatever, but thinking about like other parts of my identity and how they're tied to it and how I can use it to work through that with not necessarily directly engaging, I think has helped a lot. And just like thinking about like, well, why do I like watermelon or something like that?
I never really thought of the concept of like buzzwords in poetry. It's very interesting.
It's super interesting, especially like in like helping people edit their work. Mm-hmm. I think that's something just the Berkeley community is really, really big on, is thinking about the strength of writing, because slam is equal parts like performing and writing, I think.
Right.
Because like there are just some people who are just impeccable performers, and they can make any word sound like the most intoxicating word ever, and you're just like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. Like, talk more, say every word. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can get in the way of the writing or the work. And, like, for someone who's not performance heavy, I think I'm much more writing heavy. Like, I will do readings, but I'm not, like, good at performing. I'm just like, I'm just going to talk. Mm-hmm. I'm going to mumble. I think that, like, in reading people's work and in thinking about, there's, like, weird distinctions between poetry for the page and poetry for the stage, which is ridiculous. All, like, everything is good. Like,
right.
Something that's on the page can also be read. Something on the stage can be written. But in thinking about how you format things, or mm-hmm. the way that things are structured, or the ways that things come across on the page versus being heard, I think is something to take into account. And then, like, just editing work and thinking about, like, how many times has this metaphor been used? How many times has this staging been used? Mm-hmm. I think is really fascinating. Because that it's, really fascinating. Yeah, because it's not necessarily the easiest metaphor, but it's also just, like, the one that maybe is just so, I don't know, because there's the thing about something being accessible, which spoken word is supposed to be accessible, like the point mm-hmm. of it, like slam is like poetry for the people. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about like putting it on page, it should still, I don't know why it shouldn't be accessible still. And I think that's a really interesting argument that comes up a lot in poetry communities of
that is interesting.
Change. Yeah.
Maybe it's about like the dynamicism of it or something. I don't know.
But how do your parents feel about your poetry? Yeah.
So the first time I ever competed, afterwards I called my mom and I was like, I made the finals for a poetry competition. And she was like, wow, I didn't even know you were doing that or writing poetry. Can I read your poem? And I was like, no, not yet. Once it's edited. And I just basically gave her that like excuse for like 2 years. Yeah. And, like, every time she asked to read something.
And why didn't you want them to read it?
I don't know. So in the way that I'm open with my parents about very frivolous things, I think mm-hmm. I'm also very like tight-lipped about non-frivolous things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just didn't really want her to see me be emotionally vulnerable like that. Oh. Yeah. But yeah. And so I would keep them updated about like poetry things. Like, I got published. I hosted an event. I basically turned into a host this year, which was really fun.
That's
but
awesome.
Like, it was really fun. I love it hosting. Poetry slam jokes are like my niche humor. I love it. I love it.
That's where you thrive.
Yeah. That's I'm just funny. Like, oh my God, this audience thinks I'm hilarious. But yeah, so I would just be like, yeah, I did this poem thing. I did this poem thing. And she would ask to read it. And then finally, with the Nakba Lit Hub folio, I was like, you can read my poem, finally, because I think this one is okay to read. Mm-hmm. And I sent it to her and my dad and my brother and his wife. And I don't know if my brother and his wife read it. Probably not. And then my parents were just like, good job.
That was it? Yeah.
Basically.
Like, oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, they're like, yeah. Very good. Like, and then my mom was like, you read about food a lot. I'm like, yeah. I do.
It's a big part of what my brain goes through.
Yeah. It was pretty underwhelming. And I was like, why did I ever worry about telling my parents these things?
But it is interesting, though. I think I relate to that. I think my sisters can, too. Like, it's easier to talk to my parents about the frivolous things because the minute you are emotionally vulnerable or you decide to take that risk, they just start worrying about you.
Exactly.
That's interesting because I never thought my parents could really understand it. Yeah. If I were to give them something emotionally, like I'm vulnerable about myself, like I don't think that they would pick up that I was being vulnerable. But I think they'd be like, oh, this is interesting, but I don't think they're capable of going further than that. But I think it's also
because
of my mom
and dad
like
just worry so easily. So anything I tell them, they'll just go straight to worrying about me, you know?
I don't know. I always felt like there was this disconnect because just culturally that in their own worlds, like they're not. They don't immediately jump to, like, they're being vulnerable. They're just being like, no, they're creating something and that's that. It's almost like an act or something.
I think that's kind of how it ended up being.
Yeah. Right.
Like, I don't think, like, they necessarily realize the, like...
Yeah, the depth to it.
Yeah. My mom was kind of like, you did something that was, like, about yourself but also about Palestine. Yeah. And I was like, yeah.
That's what on the surface exactly. There we go. That is. Yeah.
And I think, so I think I was like really, really worried for nothing.
Yeah.
But we'll see as things come more and more.
Yeah. But I do feel like though, if I give my parents like something in Farsi, then they would be able to understand the depth.
Yeah.
But if it's in English, it's just like words on a paper.
There's
a
barrier. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you know, like, you give them, like, a Rumi poem, my dad's like, Rumi, you know? Like, he's such a genius. Like, I understand everything he's saying. But if I give him, like, a short film I wrote that's, like, this is me, like, transcending my emotions into this character, my dad'd be like, okay, so she goes to store.
Yeah.
And she comes home. She's mad at something.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, that, they would just, it's so surface level, they would not be able to break through it.
Yeah.
I think, same. My mom watches Arab Idol a lot, and like
is that the one you're talking about?
The Voice?
There's The Voice and Arab Idol. So she watches both. So she'll have things on, and someone will be singing, and she'll be like, "Someone, this is like high poetry. Like it's so beautiful. Like, do you hear the words? Do you know what they're saying?" And she'll like translate every line, and she'll just be like, "It's so beautiful," and like. And she'll stop and say, like, well, this can't be translated into English. And just thinking. And it's like, in Nazareth, like, in her schooling, she said that there was a class that was, like, poetic interpretations, basically. So it's literally just analyzing poetry. So, like, she has this intense background in it in Arabic. But then when it comes to English, I think when it comes to me, too, I think there's just, like, this interesting, I don't know what it is. It's new, very new, because literally... I just got home yesterday or like 2 days ago and was like, did you read my poem? So I'm interested in seeing just like how our relationship changes in poetry, because this was one that didn't mention my parents at all. Yeah. None of my family. It was very abstract.
Have they ever read anything that mentions them directly?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you ever write about them? Yeah.
Tons. Exclusively.
Naturally. My parents actually read a lot of poetry. Yeah. My dad loves poetry.
Yeah.
But of course, it's always in Farsi.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, my mom will come to L.A. and be like, take me to Westwood. I need to go to, like, an Iranian bookstore to find a certain book of poems that I really want. It's just like,
my mom
is
the exact same.
I think
poetry is a big deal in Middle Eastern culture.
I think it is.
Yeah,
I think it is.
Because even, like, the Quran, and I know you're Christian, but, like, the Quran is seen as, for a lot of Muslims, like, as, like, a poet, like, just, like, poetic words. And I think the Arabic language, and probably Farsi, too, there's a poetic aspect to it that is so hard to translate that... Like there's some things that I just can never translate to English.
Well, there's a word from that I think it might the word it shares. shares, which I don't know if that translates to poetry, but I don't exactly know, because my dad's always like, oh, share about a man. Okay, well, that's
Farsi. Yeah, it sounds similar. It's the same word.
So is that just translates to poetry? I've never honestly
Shad is like a poet.
I've never actually thought to translate it, because I rarely turn to someone and go like, have you read these shares? Oh, wow.
Stock shares?
Would you like some of my shares? That's beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think we've ever talked to anyone who actively translated their culture and their feelings towards their family and their, I guess, life situation into their art as much. Because I feel like we talk a lot of comedians and... They don't go that deep, you know?
Yeah. I think it's interesting, and I was talking about this to someone else, but there's something about being the child of an immigrant parent or parents that I think there's a sadness that we know that a lot of people don't. Like a depth of sadness that can't be comprehended by a lot of people. And I just love that you're able to utilize that for productive purposes, because I'm trying to do the same.
Well, I feel like a lot of Middle Eastern art has a sadness to it. Like, that's what they're into,
and especially for Palestine, you know. There's an infinite well of sadness there. And I did want to ask you what it was like for you to be raised Palestinian American, and if anyone like would ever talk to, like, ask you weird questions about it, or even in Berkeley, like how your identity changed when you met other Palestinians that weren't related to you. But before we get into it, let's take a break.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. You know, I was born in Berkeley.
Yeah.
No cow.
Born and lived a little.
A little. So
a lot more than a little.
So yeah, tell us all about being like, just your how you relate to being Palestinian American and like any how that changed as you grew up or stuff.
Yeah, so I guess so I was born in Ann Arbor and I lived there for the first 9 years of my life. Our neighborhood was like all like white Irish families, like and we were the only like ethnic family on the block. And I'm like hella white passing, so like the otherness was like really interesting. In that like they knew that like my family was like other, but they didn't understand, like the kids, I guess, like adults, everyone knew they're adults. But like just like my relationship to the other like kids in the neighborhood was really weird because they're like, your mom talks funny, you eat funny food. And then like this weirdness of like talking about like, I was like, oh yes, I'm Arab, and like them not knowing what that means at a really young age, or like identifying like playing princesses and being like, I want to be Jasmine, and they're like, you can't be Jasmine, you're not that, and I'm like, but that's me, like that's the only thing I have to hold to,
right?
So it went from this like really weird understanding of just like kind of having an identity withheld from me, and like growing up with like you know, not like kids not knowing anything, like being having it denied, which was really weird, into just understanding the world a little bit more and like seeing just the heavy prejudice against Arabs and like understanding it in a weird construction of like not necessarily facing like racism and colorism because of how I look, but more so after my identity is revealed, race facing like hella racism, not being Muslim but like facing Islamophobia, which is really fucking weird.
Well, there's no difference to certain people.
Oh yeah, exactly, that's a thing. Like, and that had been said to me so many times, just like in middle school there was this punk kid that sat in front of me in one of my classes and he was like going off about Muslims being terrible, and I was like, dude, like you should calm down. And he's like, I don't know. He's like, you're Arab, right? I was like, yeah. And he's like, same thing. I was like, whew, yikes. And yeah, just like shit like that. And just having this really weird feeling. And then slowly learning about like occupation and understanding like the homeland as like not really ours anymore.
Did your parents talk about it when you were growing up?
Kind of a little bit. For the most part, it was. So like I've been to Nazareth twice. I went when I was like a very, very tiny baby, don't remember it at all. And then when I was 7, so like just kind of thinking about it, it's just like, I don't know. I say like I've been to Israel, but I don't even feel like I've been there. Like I've been to Nazareth, and I've been to Akka, and I've been to Haifa. Like I've been to like the Arab communities within Israel. And like it just feels so weird to say like my parents were born in Israel. And like they don't even really say that. They like when people ask them like where are they from, they say like, oh, we're from the Holy Land. And it's just like this kind
of, I'm just curious, do they ever say Palestine or do they only say Israel?
I think they say Palestine when they're feeling particularly frustrated.
Do you have family still in Nazareth?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, like, most of my mom's family is in Nazareth.
So they're able to stay and just live.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, they're... Yeah, they're cool. But yeah, so then, and then later understanding like the prejudice specifically against Palestinians, like especially in America, just like Zionism is like fucking wild here. Like Americans are so Zionist. So, they don't even understand why they are.
No. Like they would deny it like incredibly. And
yeah.
Because they, for whatever reason, they don't even understand the actual definition of Zionism is exactly what they're doing.
Well, I just feel like they just know they have to accept anything that is like they don't know.
Yeah, they're like, we can't be anti-Semitic.
Yeah, there's one thing, so they just don't know any. That's the thing, is like there's not enough like knowledge out there. They just know what they know. They were told a certain thing, and they're like, well, I love everybody. I have no issues with anyone, and to say I have an issue with someone makes me a certain way, so I can't. And it's like, okay, that's fine. No one's telling you to hate anyone. Yeah. Just like understand what's going on, like, in different regions.
Yeah.
And it's just really unfortunate because now even standing up for Palestinian people is considered a leftist, like anti-Semitic thing, when really we're just, it's a basic human rights.
They're trying to pass that anti-Semitism
law.
Act or something or like act. That, where it just basically would redefine the entire definition of anti-Semitism that any sort of anti-Israel talk falls under anti-Semitism. Yeah.
Which is completely, the most
it defeats
absurd.
The purpose, because it has nothing to do with the state of Israel. No. It's about people.
Like, the thing about the state of Israel is, like, the government loves anti-Semitism everywhere else in the world, because builds the perception that Israel is the only safe place for Jewish folks. And it's just like... Like, Zionism is so anti-Semitic and such a violent ideology.
Well, that's the thing is, like, that's... It's the opposite of what they were built on.
Yeah.
They weren't built on, like, believing they're the number one. They're built on, like, people who believe in each other and are open to each other. And that's what they want to show. And then all of a sudden there was, like, this, like, hard right.
It's absurd. But, so just, like, kind of... I guess, like, in Southern California, in the town I grew up in, like... it was, like, a little weird sometimes, and just, like, I had friends that, like, went on Birthright, and I'm like, oh, y'all know that's, like, bad, right?
One of my best friends,
me too,
half Jewish, went on Birthright, like, I mean, she knows what she saw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She came back. My
best friend, Adam, went to Birthright, and he apologized to me when he went. He was like, I know this is really fucked up that I'm doing this, but it's a free trip and I just need to know what they're doing. And he came back and he was like, you were right. It's all bullshit and it's all brainwashing. And
yeah,
I don't even care if someone goes to Birthright. You're allowed to go see Israel. I would love to go see Israel.
But the thing is,
it's just like my family has to pay like $2,700 for plane tickets.
Yeah.
And it's just like we're like the most privileged ones. Like, we're 48ers. Like, we can feel freely. Like, I have an American passport and I don't have the like, I don't really know how this works exactly, but I know a lot of people whose families, like, they're refugees. It's like the refugee status is, like, given to, like, the children. And, like, you can be, like, Palestinian, but, like, American, born in the U.S., and you can still have problems in your passage and going to the West Bank and Gaza and, like, Israel and just, like, all those things. Like, I'm so fortunate that, like, my parents have Israeli passport and American passport, and, like, we can go. But it's just, like, it's so fucked up. Like, I have to pay so much to see my family, and other people don't have to pay anything. And it's, like, you could have converted, and you get to go on Birthright.
No,
like,
exactly.
You're not descended from ancient Israelites. Like,
my issue with Birthright is also not just the idea itself, which is absurd, but when you go there, they show you the most beautiful... Well,
it's propaganda.
Yeah, it's just all brainwashing, and it's just... It's disgusting. Yeah. I hate it so much. People come back all, like, rejuvenated and, like, obsessed with their culture.
Yeah,
and it's like,
I floated in the Dead Sea.
Yeah. No, but really, though. It's just like, I walked on
sand.
It's
very real. But I can't bring myself to, like, be mad at someone who goes on Birthright. It's like, you go and you go.
I'm not mad at them.
It just makes me feel weird.
I would agree with that.
Because the thing is, I feel like most of the people who have gone on Birthright that I, like, know of, for the most part, like, they're going when they're, like, I don't know, like, 16, 17. They don't know.
Yeah.
They don't know.
One thing, it's a free trip.
It's a free
trip. To a different country. Mm-hmm. There's just...
That you're supposed to care about because of, like, your family's religion, you know?
Yeah,
it's just, like,
for
some people who aren't devout go... But,
I guess I would just hope that they...
Learn.
They don't get sucked into anything that they're told, or, like, they have an open mind about it, or they can think for themselves and not just, like, be sheep about it, you know what I mean? Like, that's the only thing that... I don't want them to. I don't want these young people that are going to Birthright to be susceptible to this Zionist agenda, because that's my worst nightmare.
It's
to make,
like,
more of those.
You'd hope
ideas.
That, like, either after going on Birthright or, like, preparing to go, just, like, stumbling across something and understanding what you're going to do and just, like, what systems you're supporting.
Even you, like, talking to you, like, I would hope, like, an Israeli person that was able to go on Birthright would look at you and be like, wait, why can't you go for free?
Yeah.
You know, like...
Give me your ticket.
You know, because you are technically from the same place I am.
I do hear that you can get a rabbi to sign off.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Someone told me that. I don't know if that's factual.
I'll find it.
Get some research.
Well, just, like, if you're curious enough, a rabbi can, like,
that's
grant you the ability to go. Because they want people to go and learn their... propaganda.
Yeah, of course.
So, I don't know.
That's cool. I'd love to do that.
Should we go, Shireen?
Let's go.
Just really interrupt her. Yeah. The entire tour. That's not what I heard!
Be those
I read
people.
Al Jazeera! Yeah. Just be so obnoxious. God. I would never do it. I wouldn't go just to be like super obnoxious because I don't like anyone looking at me, but like
it would, also just
would
like
I would only do it if I wore a disguise.
That'd yeah, be so uncomfortable.
Mustaches. Yeah. And wigs. Like,
yeah.
Imagine just being the odd one out on a whole propaganda
First of all,
trip.
You would get kicked out of there so quickly. Yeah. They would be like, and that's a wrap on you.
Yeah.
Like, who let this anti-Semitic person in here? Yeah. Just like, how did you
just
make
like
it past
fuel
all
their
of our
propaganda?
Yeah. You just be like, I'm sorry, you got a link for that info? Yeah.
Cite your sources.
You
cite your sources.
Link the IDF Twitter. That's not a source. Yeah. Have y'all seen the IDF Twitter? It's wild.
Once or twice, and then I immediately regretted it.
Yeah, it's like, oh man. I don't know how anyone can read it and be like, yes, this is fact.
It's disgusting.
It's jokes. It reads like Trump's Twitter. Like, it's just a bunch of, like, it's joke tweets. Yeah. It's amazing, but also terrible.
It's terrible. And people are, just eat it up.
I need to stop, like, swaying back and forth. Okay.
No, you're good.
But yeah, so that was like my high school exposure to that. And then in college is where I really started seeing bad shit and like facing full out Zionist bad things for being Palestinian.
Like what? Are you okay with talking about?
Yeah. So like I guess like there are two Palestinian student groups on campus and they do like a lot of like events. So they'll do like. Each week they do like, or not each week, each month they do, not month, year. I need to do these bigger time increments. Each year they do like Palestine Week, and it's just like a series of events, like a documentary screening, poetry reading, and then they build like a mock border wall at like the entrance to campus, just to be like, this is what it's like, kind of. And then at all of those events, there's always like the Zionist student group.
Is it called?
There's a Zionist student group.
It's called the Zionist student group.
It's called like TIVA or something. It's like the Zionist Voices at Berkeley.
That's what they like. They own that word.
Oh, they own that word. Yeah, it's like in
that
their
makes
tagline.
Me furious.
Yeah.
Real quick, the pinned tweet on IDF Twitter is: the mask has been pulled. Hamas is Iran. Iran is Hamas. The tear along the security fence is an Iranian mission.
Oh my god!
What a fucking aggressive ass statement. I'm sorry, so why funny. Would you pin that?
I hate them.
Oh, too much.
Wait, I still haven't gotten over the fact that in a liberal ass city like Berkeley, there's a club on campus that uses the Zionist word in a good, like thinking it's a good thing.
Yeah.
There's probably also like, what is it? Like young Republicans.
Oh, so we have the Berklee College Republicans who cost the school over $1 million in police like security because they wanted to bring like Milo and Ann Coulter and shit.
Right.
Yeah. So we had that. That was like free speech week. Oh my God. That was so scarring.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That was so bad. That was just my school, y'all.
Holy shit. Sorry. There's also an image where it's like, what do you see when you look in the mirror? And it's an Iran flag, and then in the mirror it's a
what
Hamas.
What the fuck?
Lordy lord.
These are memes.
Yeah, they have great people working for them. IDF, you guys are out of control.
Wow.
Iran is the mastermind behind Hamas's terrorism.
They have all these graphics and everything.
There's someone making infographics
their graphic team
all day.
Is so fast. It's
I'll
amazing.
Give them that. Yeah, props to your graphics team, IDF Twitter. Like,
oh, to be the intern at the IDF office. God.
But,
yeah.
But so what would these Zionist groups do at these Palestine Week?
So they're really weak. For the most part, they just hold up the Israeli flag and like surround Palestinian students. Like, there was one time there was
to, like,
a...
intimidate them?
Yeah.
That's weird.
It's weird. They kind of, like, form, like, a border around us a lot of the times.
Oh, like, with like, oh that's not new.
An occupation, if you will.
I remember
that's
the first...
buzzword.
the first demonstration I went to, it was a series of just, like, speakers just like, talking and talking about Palestine and liberation. And there were, you know, students holding Palestinian flags and students holding, like, Zionism is racism posters, typical like protest stuff. But then there was just like Zionist kids like holding Israeli flags around us. And then other like people would like go behind them with the Palestinian flag and try to like form weird rings, and they would keep moving, and it was like honestly ridiculous. And then like at the end of the event, we marched, and they followed us for a little bit, and then we were just like, are they serious? Like, they're actually following us? And I know that like one of my friends is like the, she's like head of Students for Justice in Palestine, and she so they'll hold like info sessions and meetings and stuff, just like general meetings, just like, here's how to get involved. And at the meetings, the Zionist club will just be in the back, like taking pictures of them.
Why?
And it seems like really, really frivolous and dumb, but there's a thing called like Canary Mission, which is this Zionist database of like Palestinians. And they like dox them and like get them put on lists to like just make it harder for them to enter Palestine.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So, on the first hand, you're like, oh, my God, they're so ridiculous. They're just taking pictures and being, like, antagonistic. But it's just, like, a lot of times, like, they're actually trying to get information on Palestinian students to, like, fuck up their lives. Yeah. It's, like, really.
It's, like, because you're just your existence is a threat to them. Like,
basically,
like,
yeah.
Because just your existence means you're anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. Like, I hosted a poetry event. Like, I hosted an event, and it was, like, on International Women's Day. So it was, like, prioritizing, like, women voices and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it was just, like, a two-hour event. I was so exhausted afterwards. But, like, in between, like, when no one was signing up, I did poems just to, like, fill for time. And I did one, like, Palestine poem. And it was, like, a truly really very basic poem that was just, like, I'm a child of immigrants and I don't know my culture, basically. And afterwards, like, you know, I was talking to people, like, you know, thanks for coming, blah, blah, blah. And a person came up to me and they were like, hey, can I talk to you? I was like, sure. They were like, your poem made me uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, interesting. Why? And like, truly, I was just like, I don't know. I did two poems. Were they uncomfortable? Like me talking about my mom? What could I have done? And they were like, I was a soldier in the Israeli army and I was stationed in Nazareth for like 3 years. So just hearing your poem about Palestine made me uncomfortable.
What? Okay.
And it was just like this weirdest like intimidation tactic. It's like, should I apologize to you to like, for like,
to apologize to that?
Doing my poem? Like, yeah. I was just so, like,
you've had your experience. I've had my experience.
Yeah.
Walk away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was truly like, okay, well, maybe it's, like, on you to, like, examine why that made you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Really not
on me.
Did
you say that to him, or how did you respond?
I wouldn't know, like, how to. Yeah, that's the thing. I was like, oh, interesting. Like, I'm sorry that made you uncomfortable, but, like, that's my life. And then the person was like, can I talk to you about this? It's a complicated issue. And I was like, no. I was like, no, I don't want to talk to you. And I left. And then, like, I was freaking out afterwards because that was just, like, it's like, this person is like a soldier in like my family's town. Mm-hmm. I just like, I don't want to talk to you about like, and I hope that like, I don't know, that person went home and slept and was like in the morning like, wow, Zionism is bad. I was part of a corrupt system. That person's poem? Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I doubt it.
Right.
But yeah, so just like really small things like that and like just like encounters with like Zionists. And then,
just your existence makes it
uncomfortable. And then just like weird people. So like, I'm wearing like my Palestine necklace. I wear like my keffiyeh and stuff. And people will be like, oh, like, are you Palestinian? I'm like, yeah. And they'll be like, do you want to talk about like the conflict with me? And I'm like, no, like just random people. It doesn't matter. Like if they're involved at all.
That's what they do, though. That they're like, oh, you're Syrian? Oh, you're Iranian or whatever?
Yeah.
They're like, what do you think of ISIS? What do you think of the nuclear deal or Syria or whatever?
Yeah.
They don't realize that it's like a stab to the fucking heart every time you think about it.
It's like, I don't have the energy to unpack like my family trauma with you. Yeah. Like, let me host a book club.
That's so, I find that so frustrating. Yeah. For that person to be like, your poem made me uncomfortable. We have to talk about it. It's like, no, it was a poem.
Yeah.
Like, it was a poem. It was just my feelings.
Yeah.
These feelings aren't going to change because you have your experience. I have my experience. It's like, just let it be. Go to your therapist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Write a poem about being a soldier.
Call your parents.
Yeah. And it's just like, I think the something we do at events after, like, whoever is hosting, we say, like, if you liked a poem, go tell the poet. But just because someone has, I mean, we say this more eloquently, like, just because someone has, like, told a poem about something or written something and shared something on stage doesn't mean it's an invitation to talk to them about it. So, like, if someone shares a story of, like, their immigration, it doesn't give you, right to talk to them. Someone sharing a story of their sexual assault does not give you invitation to talk about it. And it's just, like, in this case, it's, like, yo, I don't want to talk about the conflict. Excuse me.
Yeah. But, because poetry and sharing your art in a public way like that, it's a catharsis, you know? And it should just end there.
Yeah.
You know? It's not meant for, like, a Q&A after.
No. Yeah. Yeah. And so.
Also, you're not a public figure.
Yeah, that's another thing.
You don't have to respond to anyone.
It's like, I'm a student. And the thing is, what was really frustrating is, like, I had given, like, my time and energy to host that space for 2 hours. And it's like, poetry scenes can be incredibly emotional spaces. Mm-hmm. And, like, just, like, to kind of intimidate the host like that is just so incredibly disrespectful.
Yeah. I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate that obviously, people can experience a bunch of shitty stuff, but I'm sorry that you had to go through that in where you go to school, in Berkeley.
Yeah.
My mind is this, like, liberal hub.
I know, but that's what I hate, like. People really feel like they can just start a dialogue with you. And it's like, I don't know you.
Listen.
That's why it's like when people on Twitter, like, really expect you to respond.
Oh,
it's
my,
like,
God.
I don't know you.
No one's talked to
you. Also, I don't have to respond to your whatever allegations you have. Like, I don't actually.
People get mad at us when we don't respond.
I'm a person. Like, I'm a human being. Like, I gotta go home and make myself dinner. I can't be on, like, I tweet, but doesn't mean I have to respond to your tweet. Like, I don't know you.
No obligation at all.
Yeah. And it's just, like, infuriating to expect that energy of someone, especially on something that, like, takes energy out of them. Like, it's like, dude, this tires me out. I don't really don't want to think about these things. And but just, like, stuff like that. And I think that since I don't do, like, a lot of organizing, I'm mostly on the periphery of just, like, a student group's like, Summer, will you perform? I'm like, yeah, I'll be there, get some free food and do some poems. I'm lucky in that way. But then I know that a lot of student organizers just, like, it's shitty. It's terrifying.
It's emotionally taxing, if anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's scary because the university really isn't kind to us.
Damn.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. If they let a Zionist group exist. I mean, if they think letting a Zionist group exist is in an effort of being balanced or unbiased or fair, then that's just incorrect because you're making the word Zionist into a mainstream okay thing to be.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's in, like, our campus tolerance agreements that, like, anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are, like, equated in the same thing.
Oh my God, it's annoying.
And it's like, yeah, no, anti-Semitism is terrible. That shouldn't be allowed on this campus. Zionism also shouldn't be allowed on this campus. It's harmful. But yeah, it's hard be afraid. Like, we were having an event in the multicultural community center. It's, like, supposed to be a space for, like, the safest space for students of color on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just, like, people handing out, like, Palestinian terrorism flyers just right outside a student space. And it's just kind of like,
that's a hate crime.
Yeah, like, straight up. And it's just like, if we told the university about this, would, like, anything happen? Would they be like, sucks? Or
and it's free speech.
Yeah, basically, the amount of bad things that happen on Berkeley's campus in attempts to maintain our legacy of free speech is infuriating. Like, it's really scary. Like, all of the things that happened last year, I guess, just with Free Speech Week and the anticipation of the violence that was going to occur on campus. Like, there was one day that the Near Eastern Studies Department, like, shut down. I didn't have Arabic class that day because of just danger to the majority Arab and Muslim, like, professors and students.
That's just awful.
Yeah, it's scary. But then there's also just, like, incredible community and, like, there's, like, the Palestinian Youth Movement, which is a really, really wonderful group in the Bay Area that does great work in organizing Palestinians. And there are good restaurants and people, and the students are amazing. Like, truly, the students on Berkeley's campus are so amazing. As scary as the administration can be, I'm just like, wow, students, they're so strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I wanted you to be on the podcast, really, because I wanted our listeners to hear about the Palestinian experience from an actual Palestinian, because we talk about Israel and Palestine all the time, but I wanted someone that like lived through it and is still active in your own right, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And I'm just also glad you're able to be here.
Different perspective than what we usually have on.
Exactly. Yeah. Because as you said, like even as a Palestinian American, you didn't know a lot of Palestinian Americans growing up.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people can relate to that too. They don't know a lot of Palestinian Americans, let alone an Arab American, you know what yeah. I mean? So I hope people learn something in this episode, because
yeah.
it's just good to get other people's experiences that are like they've lived through it and you haven't. So I don't know.
Yeah, and just like the amount that I've learned from just other Palestinians in the community, because like again, like my parents were fortunate, like I mean, growing up in Israel, Palestinian is bad, like it's shitty, like
yeah,
Arabs, like their license plates are like registered differently so that like mm-hmm. you know who
your
is
second
Arab
citizen.
Driving yeah, yeah exactly, like my dad told me that the other day and I was like, what?
Yeah.
They just know by looking at your car straight up, and it's just yeah. like
they're doing what yeah. I mean, not this extreme, but yeah. they're being prejudiced against Palestinians the same way they hated being prejudiced against before the Holocaust. Like,
yeah.
it's a very similar sad situation that's being repeated in the and it's not being recognized as such, which is unfortunate.
It's yeah. really frustrating in thinking about, like, I don't know, just the idea of, yeah, just the unfortunate birth of a state and how it does not, it continues some sort of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
it was created in violence and it yeah, will continue to in be violence. In violence because that's all it fucking knows.
Yeah, and it's just like yeah. it's super hard, but just like learning from other Palestinian students who like their parents like refugees or like they're from West Bank or Gaza, and just hearing all the shit they have to go through and how much harder it is just like to exist and like to travel, like financial reasons are the biggest reason why I haven't seen like my family in a long time in Nazareth, but like other people it's like literally like just can't
wow.
go.
Yeah,
and how horrifying that is.
Yeah,
but yeah, and then I am like the only like Palestinian or Arab that a lot of people know, I guess, in friend groups, and it's kind of like comforting the way that like my friends like listen to me and like I talk to them about things, and they're like very like anti-Zionist and they're like very active and vocal, and like God, on the entrance to campus there's like a table where like just these nice old people just hand out like free Palestine flyers.
Oh, nice.
But then there's always like a Zionist dude next to them just like being yeah. very rude and cruel, and like I was wearing like my kufiya one day and we were walking and
tell people
just, like,
really quick what that
oh,
is.
Oh yeah, so kufiya is, it's like a Palestinian scarf. It's like a white and black like patterned scarf. It's like kufiya or hatta. There's like different color alternatives, and it like marks like which area of the Middle East you're from, basically. Mm-hmm. So like the white and red one is Jordanian and other things.
And white and black is Palestine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like become like a really big symbol for resistance. And basically if you're wearing one, you support Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And like one of the last standing factories in like Palestine like territories is a kufiya factory in Hebron.
Wow.
So like if you want to support Palestine monetarily in any way.
And it's a great looking scarf.
Yeah, it's so pretty. It's comfy. But yeah, so I was wearing it and this man like came at me, and my friend, she's very tall and very white, and she just like pulled me and she was like, no, we're not talking to you. And it was just like, yeah, that's some like some nice allyship right there.
I like that. I like that.
But the idea of thinking like, where would they be if I wasn't in their life mm-hmm. is very frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hope everyone listening, if you're not Palestinian-American, if you know Palestinian-American Americans, just be an ally and mm-hmm. educate yourself. And I hope you learned something from this episode, because I 100% loved it.
Yay.
Yeah. Summer, where can people find you?
Yeah. So Twitter, I am at Sumabis, Sumabis. And my Instagram is at Borders Bookstore, which is just,
I wanted to ask you about that. How did you get that handle?
My friend was just like, we were just like on Instagram together, and he was like, oh, my friend from college has the at, like, I think it was, what was it, Blockbuster Video. And I was like, that's so funny. I want like, an abandoned chain as my at. And I was like, Borders, that's sort of in Michigan. Like, me. And it was free.
That's pretty great.
Great. Yeah. And then if you want to read poems, the Palestinian Youth Movement, Ghassan Kanafani anthology is available for purchase on their website. And I'm in it and other really, really dope Palestinian youths. Yeah.
That's awesome. Where's this website? Do you know the website?
It's like pym.org, I'm pretty sure.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm thrilled. Great. Yay, poetry.
I just took down so many notes.
Okay. I know. You're just writing like a maniac. I'm
What do we have?
We have Twitter.
Okay, follow us on Twitter at ethnicallyamb, A-M-B. We post a lot of... We retweet a lot. We keep you informed. We keep it moving.
In between episodes, we definitely stay on Twitter.
Yeah, we're all on Twitter. Yeah. You can follow us on Instagram at ethnicallyambig, A-M-B-I-G. We post pics of ourselves.
We post in real life.
Selfies only. Just kidding.
We'll post a pic of this.
Yes,
you
we
probably
will.
Would have seen us already.
What else do we do? We have a website, ethnicallyambiguouspod.com. Mm-hmm. You can follow me on Twitter at Anna Hosnier, AnnaHosnieh.
And I am Shereen Y on Twitter, ShereenWhy. And Instagram, it's Shirohero, ShereeroHero. But Anna is blowing me out of the water with her social media game. She has like 3 times as many followers as I have, and it's like intimidating as fuck.
What?
You're like a queen of social media, and I can't keep up.
I'm only on Twitter. My Instagram is still private. Don't bother. I'm not out here for y'all to question my photos.
But your Twitter is off the chain. Everyone loves it.
Everyone loves it. I don't know about that.
You have like almost like 4,000 followers. I barely have
that
one.
Is nothing.
But I'm just saying.
Wait till I get to a K. You'll never hear from me again.
A K?
Just kidding. Like 1,000. I don't know. I won't.
You have. I'm telling you. You have almost 4.
Do I? I don't. Okay. This is not up for discussion right now.
Anyways,
she's
a queen of social media.
I tweet a lot. I talk a lot of shit. I trigger a lot of dudes who are in my mentions being like, you've triggered me. And I ignore it because I don't give a shit. And the best part is I don't block the Trump supporters. Okay. I have 3,100. Whatever.
Wow.
That's 3K.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever. But my rule is I don't block you, I'll mute you, so you'll be just tweeting out into that sphere for days, and it's the funniest thing
That's
in the
good.
World to me.
That's hilarious. And
because they think I see this shit. I don't see shit.
Yeah, because I didn't even, I mean, until the podcast got active on Twitter, I was not really active on Twitter, and now I feel like I need to be more active, and I'm trying to my best to do that, so follow me, y'all, and give me some,
follow Shereen.
What's it called? Like, incentive to be active, please, because...
Just tweeting into the void is great, though.
That's true. Yeah. Maybe I should take advantage of that before I get too
It's
too
true.
Hyped.
Like, once you start triggering people, oh my god, they'll tell you what to tweet and how to tweet,
oh
and
my,
you're like,
we
what
already,
are you talking
also,
about?
Also, we already get asks. I mean, there are some stuff I do want to talk
ton
about.
You have a ton of followers!
You have, like, 3 times as much as I do, which is fine. I respect your game. I'm like, I praise it. I respect you and your game.
It's not about respect, man. I'm just out here triggering people.
But that's all part of it. If you are interested in reading beautiful poetry, I highly recommend Summer's work. It will make you cry. It made me cry, which is the best kind of stuff. And her Twitter is super funny. Follow her on Twitter. And yeah.
You can find that out.
Find that out.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting 2 young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, What happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.